Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. I will be joined shortly by my co-host, Chuck Snow, and our special guest for the evening, Mr. Tommy Rook and Hank Seaton. So you're in for a blast once again. It's always a good show when we have those guys joining us. But without any further ado, take a look and see how the reports were for the previous week. We have national diesel prices that are relatively unchanged. They are dropped down by 0.4 percentage points. We're showing a national average of diesel fuel sitting at $2.38 per gallon nationwide. The monthly national average for van rates hit an all-time high in October, topping the previous record that was set back in September. As disrupted supply chains see more and more freight moved on the spot market. So that's all good things. Let's take a deeper dive and see how those rates were performing over the various segment types. And starting out with dry vans, in the northeastern portion of the United States, we're showing an outbound spot market rate average coming out of the northeast at 206. Moving down into the mid-Atlantic and southeastern portion of the United States, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for dry vans at an average of 225. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at 265 for dry vans. Moving down to the south central region, we're showing outbound spot market rates at 223. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing outbound spot market rates for dry vans averaging at $2.60 per mile. Switching gears, jumping over to the skateboard or flatbed portion of the report, we are looking at average spot market rate coming out of the northeast at $2.21 per mile. Moving down to the southeastern and mid-Atlantic portion of the United States, we're showing average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.63. Moving up to the Midwest, outbound spot market rates averaging at $2.74. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing average outbound spot market rates at $2.31. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at 215. And moving over to the temperature control reefer portion of this report, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at $2.26 per mile coming out of the northeast. Coming out of the south central, southeast and the mid-Atlantic portion of the United States, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for reefers at 222. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing outbound spot market rates coming out of the Midwest at 302. The Midwest leads all segment types for as far as the average rate per mile is concerned. And moving back down to the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at 241. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate at 268. With that being said, and without any further ado, let me go ahead and welcome here my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
Doing great. Doing great. Looking forward to tonight's show.
I can't wait.
It's going to be an interesting. Yes, interesting evening to say the least. We election night here in the United States, so I know probably a lot of people are sitting back and watching with bated breath. On the East Coast, a lot of polling places are closing, so there's going to be results coming in. And it's going to be an interesting night. But with that being said, let's go ahead and welcome our guest in, starting off with Mr. Hank Seaton. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Rico. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Thanks for being on the show.
Sitting back and raring to go. And let's grab Tommy as well. We'll welcome Tommy in. Tommy, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well, guys. I'm glad to be here tonight and listen to you guys
Maybe we'll get the most sensible things we've heard in a long time out tonight.
You know what? You know what? I definitely don't doubt that at all.
Well, we need something to attract our attention, so I'm glad to be on tonight.
Well, Chuck, I'm gonna turn you loose for a few minutes and let you have at it, or let you kind of set the table for this thing. Uh oh, Chuck, you still there?
Can you hear me? Tom?
Yeah, we can hear you, Chuck.
Okay, good. I have to start out with a question for Tommy. I don't want to put you on the spot, but what are carriers to do? I'm hearing horror stories all over the United States and even Canada, of any Canadians that are running into the U.S. People do have, like even small crashes. These are, there's one person I know, single vehicle crash, not that much damage to the truck. It's not a write-off or anything. It's unfortunate. It's a $20,000 repair bill. It's not, compared to some of those nuclear settlements we read about, it is chicken scratch. And now this person's afraid to put a claim through for a cargo claim where she was hit in a truck stop by another vehicle. They had a flatbed load on and somebody ran into their load. And they're terrified of the insurance companies where, we always have looked at the insurance company as our partner, but, a lot of smaller carriers don't look at it that way. Tommy, what are people supposed to do now? Do you have any ideas?
Hank and I have talked about this before, and I'm coming from a practical side of it, Chuck, and you mentioned the cargo claim. The problem with the cargo claim is that she has absolute liability, meaning CarMac makes her a given, I assume it's interstate commerce and regulated commodities.
That's right,
so, yep. When I talk about CarMac, it only applies to that. That person who ran into her, hopefully the insurance company will seek subrogation against whoever caused that accident on there who ran into her, so she wasn't at fault. So in that case, that's one that she would want to turn in because there's somebody else there who caused the crash, not her, based on what you told me. Now, we don't know all the facts here, but the other problem is, in this situation, she's got a double sword here. The insurance companies are going to look at it and maybe have a loss and maybe rate it up, but they're not going to rate the crash as much of a negative as something else, like a theft or shortage or things like that would be preventable. In this case, this was not preventable. But the other problem is, who owns that cargo? It's her shipper. So if that cargo claim doesn't get handled, the shipper's going to be upset. She's going to lose a load. Now, maybe this trucker's financially sound enough to pay $20,000 and take care of her shipper. But that's where there's a double-edged sword. They're looking at particularly cargo. I got a problem with my insurance company, but I got a problem with my shipper if I don't make them happy. And this is something that Hank and I talked about last time about some of the forms don't cover everything. In this case, it was pretty clear cut based on your facts.
Yeah, they were in a truck stop and a truck actually. But what happened, which makes it worse, is the truck that hit them ran off. It was when the driver was either sleeping or in having a meal or a shower or whatever.
Well,
so
you
they
just
don't have anybody
what
else.
May be an exclusion from the accident, because Tommy, I think, would readily acknowledge that all insurance policies have loopholes. And on page 124 of the last policy I looked at, there was an exclusion if for any reason the driver wasn't on the truck at the time of the loss. And I have had insurance companies denied coverage under exactly that situation.
Hank, hold on a minute, Hank. That's a tented vehicle warranty. That in most of those cases, now every form could be different. And if you have somebody there who buys one that says it has to be attended there, then that agent needs to be looked at seriously here. Most of those have to do with theft. They don't have to do with a crash like we're talking about here. And the attended vehicle warranty is something there. And my first error and omission case ever got involved in was on attended vehicle warranty. What did that mean for a loaded Gatorade? But that's the whole – I totally agree with you. You got to watch that part of it. But usually it pertains to theft, not from another cause of loss, Hank.
Tommy, I don't disagree with you at all. Situation, real-life situation, $20,000 claim, insurance company says, here, in the declination letter, among a bunch of other things, was an affirmative endorsement, would you believe it, that said that the driver had to be on the truck at the time, and they relied on it to deny the claim. Now, do I think we could have taken that to court, maybe even gotten insurance bad faith? Maybe. In the meantime, the shipper deducts the $20,000
right
from the small carrier who factors his receivables. His factor
right
closes him down. And, you know, I'm sitting here saying, look, is this going to be another charity case? Is he going to be in business long enough for me to fight two insurance companies?
Hank, yeah, let me, and you agree with totally. Chuck, let me say this, and this is putting some of the stuff that we do, education. If that, the person who should be involved in this is their agent, that policy that they sold, if that was there, that needed to be told to insured and negotiated out if all possible, depending on what they're hauling. If they're hauling electronic goods, then you can understand, or pharmaceuticals or things like that. There are some precautions you have there, and Hank would agree with that, but it needs to be divulged up front. So there's a way around it. And even attended vehicles, they should define what that is, because the one I was involved in, it was a locked vehicle warranty, not an attended vehicle warranty. And so the agent should have known better and explained that to them. The problem with cargo is most too many of your insurers who are, or truckers who are listening to us, buy a cargo policy just to keep a trucker happy without going to the agent and does it really cover me. And a shipper happy, and agent will come. As Hank and have talked repeatedly, and he and I have talked about this, and I've written some white papers on it. I've shared with Hank on this, that the key is all of the policies are different. They got to fit an insurer's requirements, and that's the agent's job to do that and to explain what is and is not covered, so that agent, so the motor carrier is aware of what they can do to avoid the lack of coverage. And that's the, you know, I hate to put it back on their agent, but to me, that's the bottom line. Hank, I think you agree with that, do you not?
Well, certainly I do. And but the issue there is most of the insurance agents I know are nice guys, but they are not really in a position to read those 120-page cargo policies up. I was talking with an agent who works with one of the niche industries I'm involved with, and she is being retained by brokers in that industry to read the policies to see what exclusions exist. And, you know, she's finding exactly what I find, which is that all the policies are different, that it is a nightmare for someone even with legal eyes to read and understand it when you've got affirmative endorsements that take away what is ordinary CarMac. The only thing that I see that will drive it is if you as a insured tell your agent, I want you not to give me a silly accord that says nothing, but I want you to bring me a policy that you have scrutinized to see any exclusion that doesn't match up with CarMac, and I want you to tell me. But an insurance agent is not going to want to do that, and an underwriter is not going to want to do that. So then we end up with this peekaboo behind a 120-page contract. And, Tommy, you know that's the case. We've talked about it before. You just can't
but I would
get
think, hold on a
cargo policy.
A good agent, though, gentlemen. A good agent that is selling truck insurance that knows his or her business would be watching out for the customer and know what they're selling, would they not?
Yes.
I'm talking about somebody that sells truck insurance.
If they
part of their problem
program,
is they can't get full coverage. For a small carrier, they can get full coverage.
Hank, they can get coverage that will have enough. They will have the coverage there to cover everything that would be done. Or if not, there'll be things that they will tell the insured, like reefers. You got to turn your reefer on. You got to check the temperature. You got to fill it. If it's a flatbed, you got to tarp it. Any kind of exclusions like that. I will tell you this, and I know that you exaggerate with those number of pages. If you've got a cargo policy over 4 or 5 pages long, you've got problems. The shorter the policy is, the better the policy is, period. And because I totally agree, there are things in the back of that. But I haven't seen many cargo policies more than 4 or 5 pages, maybe 6 pages long, Hank, in those provisions in there. And
would you like
the policy.
Would you like
so
me
that's
to
a concern.
You a few, Tommy? Would you like for me to send you a few?
Well, we could look
geez,
at those
guys,
things,
you know, you were being so civil.
The longer the policy
go
is, the
it,
worse it is. I'll just say that. If I was a trucker and I'd
let me give you an example.
Ladies
and
gentlemen, this
and Tommy,
is a warm-up for later on.
You can respond to this. Many very reputable insurance companies many large insurance companies have something related to in the due course of transit. And you will get a TPA who will tell you that it's interrupted in the due course of transit if the driver went to take a pee. And you may disagree with that, and I certainly disagree with it, but you bought a lawsuit because the TPA is going to say that there was theft from a truck stop because you weren't in or on the truck stop on the truck at the time. Now that's an interpretation. That's a legal issue, but we both know that it's there, and that it happens. That a large carrier will probably get that $10,000 claim paid, but a small carrier can very easily have the TPA say go pound salt. And he finds his cargo policies canceled.
Chuck,
hey,
just to make acronyms, let me explain what he's talking about is a lot of insurance companies hire a third-party adjuster to handle the claim,
right.
And all they do is try to find out. That's what TPA means. You're not dealing directly with an insurance company. This is where, again, an agent needs to step in and help that. And if you don't have an agent with enough leverage with insurance company to get a reasonable interpretation, and by the way, Hank, that's one of my checklists. I got five or six things that I tell the agent they need to check, and one of those is due course of transit. It's an area I totally agree that needs to be addressed up front, and what does that mean? But again, an agent should be able to explain that and pick a carrier who'll take care of it. If they don't, then the agent's not doing their job. I'll just put it out that way.
Let me ask you this, Tommy, because, you know, I think Rico and Chuck have got this down to where we've got some kind of duel, and you and I basically agree on most everything. If I told you that I had a list that I would readily provide to any carrier that says when shopping insurance, you ask your agent to disclose to you before the time of binding whether or not the policy includes or excludes, and I gave you a list of the 15 horror shows we see in contracts, would you tell members of your association that they should candidly answer those questions or send us a silly accord?
Well, first off, they should never send you a silly accord. They need to address those things because I totally agree, of course, doesn't do it. Yeah, let me look at it. In fact, one of the things we're going to do at the annual conference next Tuesday is I'm going to spend an hour with someone from Rob Moseloff, Fred McIntyre, his partner, and an underwriter from an insurance company talking about cargo, and those are the things I talk about. Hank, I've shared some information I've put out since a couple times with you, and I think we're pretty straightforward that you send that. I absolutely agree. The agent has a responsibility to look at first off, my first comment is if they need the right to read the policy, before they ever buy the coverage. If they haven't read the policy, understand it, they shouldn't sell it. And the second thing they do is find out everything the insurer does. Now, part of this problem, and you know this, is that sometimes the insurer doesn't tell you everything that they're doing, or they forget to tell you something, and all of a sudden something happens. Mainly that would be involved in theft. But the insurer should say what they're hauling, and the insurance agent needs to find out, are there any exclusions and problems in the policy that will affect them, and have that conversation. If they're not getting that from their agent, they need another agent. They need an agent with the designation that we give and going through this process. Hank, I'm on the same soapbox you are. I just think the solution is getting to the source, and that is that. Now, some policies are more restrictive for some smaller carriers, but if they don't haul things, you know, I don't care if you have a reefer endorsement for a flatbed or a dry van. You follow what I'm saying? Or spoilage. It depends on what you're hauling. That's the problem, having one quote uniform policy.
Here's part of the issue where we're – gentlemen, this is part of the issue where people are getting into trouble more frequently. People get carried away, and they get they start following the spot market. And they go into areas they're not familiar with, and they end up loading freight that they're not familiar with. And that's when these boys and girls end up getting into trouble because all of a sudden they get freight from off a load board or from a broker or whatever, and they're not given the whole story sometimes. And they go and they load a load, and it turns out it's a load of electronics. They didn't know what they were picking up. Because it's being, it's not coming from Zenith Electronics. It's coming from Kuehne+Nagel or Schenker Warehouse. So they have no idea that all the driver and the dispatcher knows is, you know what, they're picking up load 6487 and they're supposed to load a dock door 27A. That's all they know.
Only the thief knows the value of the goods. But let me ask you something, Chuck. I'm going to put you on a spot. You are in perishable commodities as both a broker and a carrier. How many of the carriers that you retain are able to tell you that with respect to perishable commodities, they've got anything else other than reefer breakdown?
That's what most of them have.
What you're telling me is that I can only think of one or two insurers in the marketplace that will go beyond that. What you're telling someone is if you're hauling a refrigerated load, in order to be able to satisfy your customer, you are going to have a big gaping hole unless you can prove that the temperature damage was a result of reefer breakdown, and the first thing you've got to do is prove to the satisfaction of your insurer that it really was a mechanical malfunction. So you've got two battles before you get started. You've got to defend against the cargo claim, and you've got to sue your insurer.
And it's a tough spot. Go ahead, Tommy.
Well, I was going to say, Hank, there are a few more that offer that coverage. And I talk about the spoilage and temperature change exclusions, but I agree with you, particularly if you're hauling things subject to the Safety Food Modernization Act. It even compounds things even more because now you have just a slight temperature change can have the load rejected where other things they without that law it would not be as easy to have the shipper rejected and have no salvage. But I agree with you that that's a real concern you have again for food goods, and I point that out. But the same token, Hank, this is why one policy doesn't fit all. This is why the agent needs to tell the insured what they need to do. Maintain it, keep it, the fuel in it, set the temperature right, have the driver check the temperature before they put it on the trailer and take some of those precautions, and they can avoid some of that. I've had a case where they couldn't prove it. Go ahead.
You know, I got to tell you, gentlemen.
I don't want to trump over you. I was just saying that when you mentioned the Food Safety Modernization Act, it does not have one damn thing in it that says you can reject, crush, and dump a load. It doesn't run contrary to CARMAC or general principles of cargo claims, but every major retailer of groceries puts in their contract that they can reject it for any reason, and they can dump it for any reason, and that they can deduct it from the motor carrier. And the insurance company just sits back here and says, well, you didn't prove your case. We didn't get a chance to look at it. You signed a contract provision that waived your coverage. And so what am I left to do representing small carriers who are in that position? If, you know, I say I can't fix stupid, if they sign a standard contract that says that the shipper can reject it for any reason, you know, if he takes a temp tail on the back of the trailer and finds out that it's 3 degrees above temperature around, he can destroy the whole damn truckload, even though it's because it was opened in the hot Memphis sun. That right. makes hash out of handling cargo claims, and the contract provides that the broker can just simply extort the money out of the freight charges. So the poor little carrier is sitting here having to eat a $40,000 loss on a load of cabbage. Maybe it's $20,000, but to a small carrier, that's a big issue. And he doesn't have access to the premium policy.
Most of the better brokerage houses were a little more cautious now who were loading with valuable perishables. You know, you talk about loads of berries sometimes. They're worth a fortune. We would rather not handle the load than put it on a guy with a 20-year-old reefer because it's just not worth the risk. It's just, you know, we've had experiences just like everybody else, and you develop a criteria of what has to be done. And we don't want to be loading the older trailers, and we're careful who we load. You know, if it's a load of melons or something that's not worth a whole lot, you're not really going to make – they're not that temperature sensitive, not like a load of blueberries. Those things are just, you know, they're worth over $100,000 a load. So that would put a little
carrier
out of the
time. Let me ask
you
this, Chuck. If it's loaded hot out of the valley and the driver doesn't get a chance to pulp it because they won't let him on the dock, don't you have a cargo claim going
there
somewhere to happen?
Well, you
I
know
mean,
what?
Isn't it just the fact that loads are rejected for temperature problems? And my guess is the reefer breakdown is probably less than 20% of the problem. You know, sometimes
well, yeah,
you just got to block chute and you didn't even load it.
Hank,
this is why again,
you.
And it's a couple things here, and we need to, you know, first off, I have said often, and you gentlemen who listen to me have said this, the most important policy a trucker buys is their cargo policy because that keeps your shipper happy. And that's also the most difficult policy to buy because there's no really standard motor carrier. There's so much variety in the marketplace. And the insurance carriers, again, as Hank just said, has a lot of variety in policy. So the only choice is to get an agent who helped them walk through that kind of a scenario. And that would be the only answer I have. But there could be some driver training in that area to make sure the driver, in the case that you just pointed out, when
100%.
They sign the receipt, make a note that shipper loaded, counted, the driver didn't get checked the temperature, arm them with the thermostat and check the temperature. And if that temperature is
100%.
Different than what they have to keep it at, note it on the receipt. That's our defense. It's education on both sides. But I agree with you
yep.
that they sometimes don't take the caution to do that. And we can't excuse that.
Any good driver that's any experienced driver, if they will not let him pulp a load of produce, the first thing he'll do is he will call whoever gave him that load and get a release to protect himself. Because you load a load of hot produce in the valley, you're not going to get very far and that reefer is going to malfunction. It's going to ice up. It's just, you know, you're taking produce that's 103 or 105 degrees, and you set the reefer for 35, and I don't have to tell you that reefers aren't meant to, they're not refrigerators. They're meant to keep things cold, but not to bring them down in temperature.
I preach that.
Tommy, you grew up in
a Thermaking is there. to keep the temperature at that level. It's not to cool it
exactly
or heat it. It's exactly. They're not designed to reduce the temperature more than 1 or 2 degrees. And if you shrink it can't even do that.
The core temperature of that product is just simply to be maintained. And, you know,
right.
the problem is you almost need a degree in thermodynamics to be able to haul produce because, you know, it takes an expert to be able to read the reefer temps. And from that, you can almost deduce whether it was hot when it left the valley. But, you know, cases don't get to that level of expertise without us silly lawyers getting involved and it taking 3 years and costing more than the claim's worth. That's a large part of the problem. The people over on the fresh fruit and vegetable side weren't as regulated and weren't as ed up with lawyers as things have gotten. And it used to be that those kinds of cases would go to arbitration or mediation.
Right.
And, you know, people that had some sense about it would call balls and strikes without making it into World War III. But it seems now that insurance companies and TPAs and everything is so litigious that the shippers just insist on a unilateral offset. They don't want to wait 6 months to get the thing resolved. And,
sure,
you know,
all
that hassle gets pushed down on the little guy. His factor's yelling at him because all of a sudden he doesn't have $40,000.
Chuck, let me ask you this question. You're a broker in this area, and you do some broker loads. Hank already mentioned about brokers hiring an insurance agent to help them read policies. I'm the broker who – you remember John Giroux, I assume. He died about 6 months ago or so. He bought my father's pickle business, and I've been involved in the same thing, where he has a certain set of policies he will accept or not. And brokers are doing more and more than that. But to me,
100%.
If the broker makes a commitment to the shipper to take care of their loads, the dumbest thing they're going to do is give it to a trucker who doesn't know how to haul it and doesn't have the right coverage.
Exactly.
So part of that gets back to who chooses these things. I think to me, and I've argued, and I wrote this in a couple of papers, one of the things the broker's done to do a good job, and I don't want to sting Hank over there because we agree on this, is the broker doesn't tell them what the load's worth. I mean, how many times they accept the $100,000 limit and the load's worth $220,000 and the trucker's responsible for $220,000? And that's the kind of stuff that the broker is a party to this kind of discussion, too.
If the broker
About 10 years ago, a large broker that I was working with had about 10,000 carriers under contract, and we kept having these problems, particularly on the refrigerated side. And I told him, I said, look, you know, I will survey all of the major insurance folks, and I will review their contracts, and I will first of all ask them if they will disclose to me whether or not their standard policy covers the same kind of things I was asking Tommy about the agents. So I sent out these letters to 18 of the underwriters, and I got only two to respond. And the two that respond probably had the best coverage in the business. And a gal who's a friend of mine and Tommy's, when I talked about what I considered to be the circle of death at the Marine Underwriters Convention in Williamsburg, stood up and said, Hank, my clients are never going to tell you what their policy says. They're never going to give you a straight English answer on that. And so
send me your list, Hank, and I'll get you that. I disagree with that statement because they'll say what's there. There might be some gray areas that they want an interpretation of with some facts that might not make sense, but until something happens. But the policies and the policies are getting better. You have to admit this, Hank, and that's because I think brokers and shippers are paying more attention to it. In fact, the cargo policy has been the most rewritten policies in the last 4 or 5 years because of that pressure, and they're better now than they used to be. But again, you've got to be aware of the ones you're buying, and again, you've got to leave it up to the shippers to select to set motor carriers who have the right coverage. And so it's got to be a two-way street. Chuck, your cohort there hasn't said anything. Is he just listening to us?
No, I'm definitely paying attention. I'm listening in and taking notes. I got something
notes.
I want to. I got something that I want to interject. Good friend of the show. This probably be for you, Hank. Good friend of the show made a post on Facebook today, talking about a word or verbiage in a broker's contract. So I'm gonna read this real quickly and kind of get some feedback off of this one. So
okay.
It says right of offset and right to our customers. Here's another contract term that takes the cake. We've discussed this right of offset, the ability for a broker to hold all of your money, even for other loads, if there is a claim. This one takes it a step further. They even want to bill your other customers. When we questioned them about it, their canned response was, this is a standard contract. They replied, no, sir. We've seen thousands of broker carrier contracts. This is the first that we've seen of this absurd wording. Obviously, this got the red ink treatment from us. We're waiting to hear back from them today if they will accept our changes. But here's in quotations, in addition to broker's right to offset against amounts broker owes carrier in the event carrier fails to pay damages, claims or other expenses set forth herein, (1) carrier shall be required to provide broker advance notice of all future transportation services that the carrier provides to other parties until the damages, claims, or other expenses have been repaid.
That is so silly. That is so silly. It doesn't even deserve a comment. Let me address something that I'm undertaking.
There are three more sections. Hold on.
Three more. Oh,
let
no.
it roll, Rico.
Yeah,
It already gets an F. Like the
late night information commercials. Wait, there's more. Carriers shall be required to submit all of carriers' invoices for freight charges to broker with supporting documentation so that broker may invoice carrier's customers until the damages, claims, or other expenses have been repaid. 3, carrier assigns to broker the rights to collect payments, carrier services, or any other amounts owed to carrier, including but not limited to third-party liability claims for amounts owed to carrier, and apply the payment to the amounts carrier owes broker, including attorney fees. Or carrier grant to broker a lien in the charges for such services and amounts owed. And 5, finally, carrier shall hold harmless broker for enforcing these terms.
Oh, my God.
So, listen.
Just this whole evening has been worth its time based upon you sending me that. Whoever that is, I want to see the contract.
Send it to me too. That's ridiculous. I'm in
the process of grading contracts. It has come up. It's become obvious that broker contracts are all put through third-party administrators. They've all got the same dirty dozen. Small carriers are told, you go through the third party, and the third party says, we can't negotiate a term, sign it as it is, or go pound salt. So as a result, particularly small carriers are having to sign draconian provisions for which they have no coverage. This has got to end. And small carriers can't read and understand an insurance contract. They need somebody to help them, whether it's 10 pages or 124, and they certainly cannot be held hostage by the tyranny of the immediate to sign these contracts. I've started grading them and assigning points, what risk transfer is involved and what the effect is. And it really is a risk transfer. When you get away from CARMAC, when you get away from the 30-day pay, when you get away from giving up any interest or attorney's fees, all of these things are lethal. So I've just started grading contracts as they come in. And I've got a little tick list that I'm putting together of what to look for in these contracts. And this power of offset and the waiver of inspection and mitigation is just lethal. I understand why shippers and brokers insist on it. They don't want to get dorked around for a year and a half getting a cargo claim paid, and they've got the political clout to insist upon it. I mean, I understand why it's there, and I also understand that the broker industry feels as though they're being pushed by their customer to accept carrier duties, and just to be competitive, they're assuming these kind of outrageous demands for reject it, crush it, and dump it. So they just put it in their standard terms, just pass that liability on down the road. And, you know, you can say that that's part of the problem of a free economy. You know, the big guy pushes the little guy around. You know, that's why we got things like the CARMAC Amendment. That's why we've got dispute resolution. That's why people of good intentions ought to say, look, we want to call a ball and strike on this. We don't want it to hang around and get the lawyers involved for 2 years taking depositions. This is a simple cargo claim. But offset is one of the most hideous things and devastating things to a small carrier. And, you know, you're going to have to sit – your truck's going to have to sit a lot because some of the big people just say, well, we're going to offset it. But, you know, they're more quickly to offset it against a small carrier who's got flaky insurance than they are the big guys. What can I say?
Well, it's, you know what, Hank? In fairness, though, that, you know, the none of the brokers want to wait, you know, a year and a half, 2 years for a claim to be settled. And that's for that reason, the clout that the broker does have is say, listen, we're not releasing any funds until, you know, sometimes what we do, because we want to work with our carriers, all we need is a letter from the insurance company saying, yeah, we are, this is being covered on this insurance. But what happens so frequently to brokers, you have a claim from a carrier, and carrier goes out of business, insurance doesn't want to cover the claim, and the broker's sitting, and he's owed $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000. So what's the broker supposed to do? So that's why a lot of times all we're asking
if the broker is a true broker, his role is to facilitate the handling of the claim. If the broker wants to accept liability for the claim, which most do, then he needs to be a freight forwarder. He needs to have his own insurance, and he needs to have his insurer adjust the claim and take the subro rights. It has gotten so squirrely that I would bet that 80% of the transactional brokers are accepting liability for cargo loss or damage and taking flaky contingent cargo coverage so that they don't work the claim. And since they're not in there working the claim and paying the claim, they are offsetting it, which means the claim never gets resolved. And, you know, those are two different things. My argument is that if you are going to sign one of these shipper broker contracts that says it's between the shipper and the broker hereinafter referred to as carrier, you got to realize that you're accepting obligations that are beyond brokerage. And at that point, don't go get contingent cargo that 2 years after it's over is going to deny the claim. Go ahead and pay the upcharge and get yourself freight forwarder authority and get your man in there working the claim in the first 30 days. It's going to cost you more, but it certainly reflects what we understand as traditional commerce law, You know, if you're the lead carrier on an interline shipment under CarMax, they can file the claim with you, and if you have to pay it, then you've got a right of indemnity over the guy who was responsible for the loss. That's the only way that the brokerage industry is really going to make sense out of this. I agree. The shipper deserves to have his claim handled by a professional in real time and shouldn't have to be chasing carrier's flaky TPA 6 months later. But if you're going to make that part of your sales process as a broker, step up to the bar and get in there and adjust the claim. That's what the shipper really wants.
Okay, I got a great question for you, Hank. What's the story on some of the big forwarding companies, such as, and I'm not afraid to mention their names, they're fine companies, Schenker and Kuehne+Nagel, companies like that, worldwide companies that are forwarders, amongst other things. They do a customs brokerage and they do freight brokerage. What's been your experience when, because they broker freight to carriers all day long, are they taking the role of a forwarder or a freight broker?
Well, you've got part of the thing is, and I do a lot of work with air forwarders, and Schenkel and
right.
Kuehne+Nagel and those kinds
right.
of people are big
yep.
players in that. And you've got multimodal
huge.
Liability because if it comes in by air, it's got one limitation. If it's going by boat, it's got another. So the cargo thing
right.
is all over the hoop. As you can imagine, those large companies have pretty tough contracts, but they're not as they're not as wild as the standard transactional broker contract. You know, they do have, and I've had to negotiate some of them on behalf of air freight carriers. There is more understanding because, you know, a lot of those things are really negotiated initially with the airlines. And, you know, they're realistic in terms of their limitations of liability. And the real problem that I have is the law is all over the lot as to when surface freight forwarding is involved and when it is exempt from surface freight forwarding and CarMax. If it has a prior or subsequent movement by air, usually it's subject to Montreal Protocol, which is a whole different standard. If it's substituted motor for air, and most of it that's domestic now because
right.
of the hassle of getting it on and off a plane never
right.
sees a plane. Well, you know,
which,
traditionally
yeah.
those guys wanted to bring in the air rate, which was 50 cents a pound. So you'll see
right.
a lot of people who are providing substituted motor for air, and the limit of liability is 50 cents a pound. Well, at that de minimis value, the rate reflects it, and the cargo claims aren't all that hard to handle. But,
right.
you know, if you get a transactional broker who gets in here and says, well, look, I want next day service, but I want you to have $250,000 on every load. It doesn't matter whether we're hauling toothpaste or bullion. It's a whole lot different situation. So, yes, you know, there is a thing called a surface freight forwarder. I was talking to a client today who's in the furniture business, and they said, you know, 20 years ago, they were the largest surface freight forwarder off the West Coast. So that's an old topic that's been around for a long time. And the real difference is they don't have to stay with assembly and distribution of LTL shipments, but they are a non-asset-based carrier. So they don't have any safety
okay.
obligations, but they do have CarMax and they do issue bills of lading. And they
so
did get caught up in MAP 21. They do have to have a bond.
Okay.
Chuck.
So they're part of it too.
May I suggest something here? We got people,
go ahead.
I hope, listening to you. I know that this and you guys do this part of it. And what we need to talk about, I think, because Hank and I can talk technical things and you can talk technical things, but the trucker needs to do a better job knowing the broker and knowing the shipper and knowing what they're hauling and having the courage to realize that one load from the wrong shipper could put them out of business, and they need to pass on that. They also need to get an agent who's willing to help them through this quagmire. Because I agree with Hank, you cannot hire a lawyer every time you have a dispute in it and watch these contracts sign. And I think that's what they need to have. And maybe with the shortage of trucks right now and looking at some of the other stuff, this is a time for people to be more insistent on being fair. That's all we're trying is to be fair. And I think that's what they need. I think Hank agrees with me that what we talk about here, there's always outliers. So my point is, and this is where I sent you earlier, even about nuclear verdicts, we got a lot of discussion with that. I really talk about what you can do to avoid these kind of things. And that's have the driver be better educated to find out what they're hauling, find out the value of their hauling, and deal with an agent who can walk them through what they're hauling to make sure they got coverage and what they need to do to make sure the coverage is still in force is in place. And that just takes both sides talking, or three sides, four sides, you throw the broker in, talking to each other.
100%. But I do want to mention something. You've got and I don't want to mention any names on the air here. You've got a very large insurance company in the U.S. that is offering truck insurance at crazy rates, and they're not going through brokers. You go direct to them. And I have huge concerns that people out of desperation are going to this company direct without a broker. And I think personally, from the little bit I know, I think it's insanity. I wouldn't do it with a 10-foot pole. What's your opinions?
The first thing is, depend on the coverage. Auto liability, you're more consistent than coverages, and the smaller carriers are basing it on ISO policies, and the only wrinkles that you might find involved in those wrinkles, Chuck, would be something like a driver warranty, where if you don't have an approved driver, there's no coverage, but there's not, and there's some limitations on pollution coverage, but most of those are going to be standard ISO, because those policies have to be filed with the Department of Insurance. And the Department of Insurance is not going to allow a motor carrier or an insurance company to have a policy to sell citizens in that state that is too lack of coverage. Cargo is a completely different world. Cargo is where they need to be careful with it, and that's where you've got it all over the board.
But they're buying it all at one place, and that concerns me that we're going to have carriers that aren't educated, obviously, especially newer carriers that out of desperation are going to this entity. They're buying the whole package. They're not going to one agent to buy their cargo and another agent to buy their auto liability. They're buying it all from the same place. And
well, that
you don't have
that company also works through retail agents.
Okay.
Yeah, it does. The problem that we have with that company, I've got a cargo claim with them. It's a chump change cargo claim. They're working well with me. I'm very surprised. The issue that my little guys have with it is it's the only market, particularly for a newbie, that they can get written. And
as
you were mentioning, one accident come renewal time, they're out of business. You know, it's tough, particularly on the liability side, because one thing, and we're about to run out of time here, but I wanted to mention, depending on how tonight goes, the independent contractor model is really in deep mess, and there may be a rush of more owner operators into getting their own authority, but it's particularly difficult given the incredible high insurance rates for a newbie. ATRI just came out with its new top issues, and I don't think much of the way they sample it, but obviously the cargo insurance was number three. It probably ought to have been number one or two, because the rates, particularly on liability, are just absolutely crazy. And, right. You know.
I want to hang. This is your truth squad. It's actually, since I got the study in front of me, for shipper, for carriers, it's actually the fourth highest one on there, following up their nuclear verdict study they had. And it's not on at all on the driver's side. You can understand that. But the point here is, because ATRA is well known, this needs to be talked to shippers to hope. In fact, one of the things ATRA suggested in that finding is to have a surcharge for insurance, like you do for fuel and for contracts and things like that. Yeah, I mean, this is what the answer right now. We can leverage that.
Gentlemen, we're going to run out of time, but I want to say something here before Rico shuts us down. What it is, if your government tonight or whenever the election results finally are counted, if it swings towards a Democratic government totally, and we have fears of changes for trucking and the independent contractor, if that's going to go the way of the dodo bird, if that happens, I want to have both of yous back, and I want to throw this out to you and to all of our listeners. I've had a lifelong or a dream for a long time of forming a cooperative, and a truck cooperative, and we get a whole bunch of carriers in it, and we provide the authority, and we all own a piece of it. And I want the single, I really do want the guys with one truck, because those are some of the best people out there in the business. And what we do is we just, everybody owns a piece of this. And I want to discuss the insurance coverage for this, if we could do it. Hank, I want to talk to you about the legalities of cooperatives. I've had a little bit of experience and a real smidgen of it with a tenant of mine, a building I own in Toronto, that's actually a bicycle shop that's a cooperative. And they had me into a cooperative meeting one day of a bunch of different cooperative businesses, and it was enlightening. And I see a great way of doing business and being able to get around some of this cumbersome legislation that's going to be coming our way if things go a certain way tonight. So just putting it out there.
Chuck, you know I'm on the same page as you. Right. I mentioned this, I guess, a year ago, Chuck, or maybe longer. I think that's something I have a game plan in my mind based on early discussion about a possibility to do that. Some of the problem you're going to have is that cooperative's got to be a broker or a motor carrier and fit the regulations, but you can develop 100%. The relationships between the parties around that to be done. So it can be done.
100%.
It's not as easy as a bicycle shop, is what I will say.
Yeah,
right.
The issue is we've been casting around to try to look at captives and things like that to deal with the insurance issue.
I'm just talking about ownership. Anyway you look at it,
owning a piece though has to correlate down if you've got 1,000 motor carriers. Guys who can't be owner operators and have to have their own authority, they've all got to have the $1 million worth of endorsement filed, and somehow you have got to put in place the safety mechanisms to convince the insurance company that this is the best breed of small cats there is, that they deserve special treatment, because it really gets down to reducing that entry cost and that big premium,
100%.
And having some insurance options, and that's something.
100%. And you know what? Some of them are actually existing carriers that have had substantial raises to their insurance without any claims, just because the insurance company sent them a letter. Tommy, you know about that. It happens.
No, right. Because the insurance companies lost money, even the ones you mentioned earlier,
and they're raising
the rates
to cover that.
And so, that's the underlying problem they have. There are things that Hank just talked about, the electronics and all that, they can offset some of that part of it. They got to be willing to make those investments. driver training. If you look at the 100%. Actors report, the first four things involved in Actors report from a driver standpoint have to do with the driver: pay, retention, detention, and benefits. Those are the things there, and that's what we need to pay attention to keep the good drivers behind the wheel. So we need to develop a partnership in this, both the insurance carriers as well as the shipper and broker carrier. I would suggest if we do that, to leave the lawyers out of it. But other than that.
we're going to have to leave it right there for right now. Man, we got about 10 seconds left in the show, so we don't really have time to. But transportationlaw.net, if you want to get in touch with Hank Seaton, tell me, how do they get in contact with you?
MCIEF, Motor Carriers Insurance Education Foundation.org, O-R-G, MCIEF.org, or Chuck can tell them how to get a hold of us. And so can get a hold of
all right.
Chuck at traffics.com. If anybody needs anything, reach out to me, and I'll get to you whatever you need.
Well, we told you at the beginning of the show it was going to be a blast and action packed from start to finish. So
it certainly was.
We want to thank.
I'm going to let Tommy have the last word. Tommy just Root. Keep the lawyers out of it. Everything will go great. Get over to your insurance companies. I'll tell you. Have a happy day, guys.
and you know what?
Tommy Rook and Chuck Stowe, this is Rico Muhammad signing off. This has been the Racing Lanes podcast. We'll see you guys next week, same time, same place. God bless you. Good night. Keep it in between the muscles.
I got you on the flip-flop.
Night, guys.